You're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today is Monday, March 1st, 2010, and today in Burlington, the sun rose at 6:31 a.m. and is due to set at 5:39. So that's 19 more minutes of daylight than last Monday. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with Vermont novelist Howard Frank Mosher, who the Los Angeles Times has called a combination of Ernest Hemingway, Henry David Thoreau, and Jim Harrison. Author of 10 novels and a travel memoir, Howard Frank Mosher was born in the Catskill Mountains. He has lived in Vermont's fabled Northeast Kingdom since 1964 and has won many awards for his fiction, including Guggenheim and National Endowment for the Arts Fellowships, the American Academy of Arts and Letters Literature Award, the American Civil Liberties Award for Excellence in the Arts, the Vermont Governor's Award for Excellence in the Arts, and the New England Book Award. Three of his novels, Disappearances, A Stranger in the Kingdom, and Where the Rivers Flow North, have been made into acclaimed feature movies by the Vermont independent filmmaker Jay Craven. Howard Frank Mosher and his wife of 44 years, Phyllis, have a grown son and daughter. His Civil War era novel, Walking to Gatlinburg, comes out in bookstores tomorrow. That's March 2nd, 2010. The book chronicles the nightmarish odyssey of 17-year-old Morgan Kinnison from northern Vermont to Tennessee during 1864. I tend to think of Howard Frank Mosher as the patriarch of Vermont fiction. And when I spoke to him in February, I asked him to talk about his background and how he came to be a Vermont writer.
Well, I've always wanted to write stories. And I came from a great big Dickensian storytelling family. Mm. My grandparents had a 26-room farmhouse, very dilapidated, no running water, no electricity, in upstate New York. And they didn't have a penny of money, but they had just an incredible gallery of relatives and shirt-tail relatives and neighborhood ne'er-do-wells who lived in this monstrous, dilapidated house. And every single one of them had stories to tell, including my grandparents. Mm. So from the time I was 5 or 6 years old, that's all I ever wanted to do. Didn't have a clue in the world how to do it, but I knew that's what I wanted to do. And I can remember when I was barely able to write, trying to, you know, turn out little westerns and ghost stories and fishing stories, hunting stories, baseball stories. So when I majored in English at Syracuse.
Okay.
And when I got out of school and married Phyllis, who now my wife of 47 years and my former high school classmate and girlfriend.
Oh, wow.
I thought that there was some blueprint out there someplace, if I could only find it, that would show me how to write stories that somebody would want to read. So I thought maybe graduate school was the place to look. And was I ever wrong about that? We didn't have any money, so we decided we would teach for a year or two and save some money and then go to graduate school. Mm-hmm. Phyllis's field was science. And we heard about a couple of teaching jobs here in the Northeast Kingdom at what was Orleans High School, now is part of Lake Region Central School. We borrowed my grandparents' old Super 88 Oldsmobile, and we drove up from Syracuse to the Northeast Kingdom. And when we left Syracuse, it was it was April. It was spring. The daffodils were up. But as we traveled north from Hardwick into the Northeast Kingdom, we began to hit snow and the ponds were frozen. And we went out around Lake Willoughby just to see it because we'd heard about it. And Phyllis looked up at the lake through the gap in the mountains, and she said, "My goodness, this place really is a frontier. It looks like the glacier just came through here 2 minutes ago," which it did and does. When we got to Orleans, it was a Saturday afternoon, and the town was deserted except for two guys right out in front of the bank having a fist fight, going right at it, right in the middle of the road. And I was very young, very naive, and I didn't think I could get by them without running into them, so I rolled the window down and I said, "Excuse me, but could one of you gentlemen please tell us how to get to the local high school?" And one of them, they stopped fighting, and the taller of these guys said, "We can do better than that. We can take you there." So they piled into the back of Graham and Gramps Oldsmobile, which smelled like the Budweiser brewery for the next 2 weeks. And they were very drunk, and so they directed us down, you know, blind alleys and over in the Ethan Allen Mill Yard, and eventually got us to the high school. And when they got out of the car, Phyllis reached over and tapped me on the shoulder, and she said, "Look back." And I looked back over my shoulder, and the gentlemen had resumed their fist fight in the middle of school street.
Oh,
so we
gosh.
Knew we'd come to an interesting place. But what we found here was just a gold mine of stories that, mm-hmm. that nobody had ever written before. I think Robert Frost has a poem set on Lake Willoughby, "A Servant to Servants," and other than that, no writer had ever really touched this area.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of the stories that we heard dated back to the Prohibition era and the Depression era. And they were wonderful stories about moonshining and whiskey running and, you know, one horse hard scrabble logging and five cow farming. So we knew we'd found just a treasure trove of stories, but I still didn't know how to write them. So after a couple of years, I actually applied to the program at Irvine.
You did? Okay.
And got a fellowship.
Oh,
so
okay.
We hated to leave the Northeast Kingdom, but out we went to California, where I was going to find the blueprint for how to write. And within hours of hitting Southern California, I knew that I'd made the worst mistake of my life, but I didn't really know why. I thought it was culture shock. It was Southern California that I didn't like, and I really didn't like it very much. I looked around for a place to catch a trout, and there aren't any trout in Southern California, so I was a, you know, country kid, born and bred, and I was a fish out of water. But didn't have anything to do with Southern California. I'll get to that in a minute, but
yeah.
I knew this was a terrible mistake without quite being able to put my finger on why. So Phyllis said, "Well, let's take a ride and see if we can get some perspective on this situation." So we drove up to Los Angeles, and we found ourselves just by sheer coincidence at the intersection of Hollywood and Vine. And I've always wondered what we would have done if the light there had been green instead of red. It was red. We stopped, and a telephone truck pulled up beside us. And I think that the driver must have seen our green Vermont license plate, because he leaned over and he shouted out the passenger window, "I'm from Vermont, too. Go back while you still can." And we did, right on the spot. No MFA program, nothing, no college teaching job to fall back on, nothing. So back we came to the Northeast
story.
Kingdom. Well, it gets even better. When we got back, Phyllis found a teaching job, but there were no English teaching jobs available. And that was a good piece of luck, because I heard about an old horse logger named Jake Blodgett.
Mm-hmm.
Who needed a helper, and went out to see him. And Jake was, he would have been in his late 60s at the time, about my age now. And he was a tall guy with snowy white hair and very piercing blue eyes. And he looked me over and he said, "Well, what have you done for work before?" And I had to admit to him I'd been a teacher. And he said, "Well, that ain't going to help you up in the woods with me, school teacher." But he took me on, and I worked with Jake all that fall and winter. And he told me many of the stories that wound up in my first two books.
Mm-hmm.
and became the model for the river driver Noel Lord, and where the rivers flow north.
Right.
And a few years later, when our son was born, we named him Jake after this old logger. But to go back to California for just a minute, the mistake I'd made wasn't really going to Southern California. I realize this now. But it was cutting myself off from all this material here in the kingdom mm-hmm. before I really knew enough about it to write about it. And, you know, the blueprint, I think the blueprint is probably the classics. Read the classics and read them carefully. But that's the only blueprint that I know of. I wasn't going to find it out there. That might have given me some time to write. And I might have learned some interesting things about technique that took me longer to learn on my own.
Right.
But I just didn't have the material to write yet until I came back and immersed myself in this area.
So you'd rather immerse yourself in the material and learn how to write than immerse yourself in an academic setting without your material.
Well, as it worked out for me, yes, but I'd never advise a writer not to go to an MFA program, because there are important things you can learn there. You can do a lot of reading there. You can take some literature classes, and there certainly would have been some things that my teachers could have taught me that did take me much longer to learn on my own. But for me, it wasn't right, because what I wanted to do was to write about this gold mine of stories that we found, and I needed to learn more about this area.
Here.
So that's what I did. I did eventually go to graduate school, but in literature, not in writing.
Oh, okay.
And that was very helpful.
Where did you go?
UVM. I got a master's degree in English and American Literature, and that's probably where I learned how to read carefully enough to. That was the next step in my education.
Yeah. And have you ever taught since then?
Off and on, uh-huh. Yeah. But the trouble I've had with the teaching is that it is, if you do it right, it's a full-time job and then some.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are going to write novels that, Walkman Gatlinburg case in point, takes 7 years, 50 or 75 drafts. Originally, this was, I don't know if I told you over the phone, 1,100 and some pages.
You told, and actually I have a question in here about your revision, which I was so excited to hear, first of all, that it took you 7 years and 40 or 50 drafts or whatever it was.
Absolutely.
Because that's, I think, very helpful to people who struggle alone with this sort of thing and have never published. So
it would have been helpful to me when I first started to know that, because I thought that the writing would come more quickly, and when it didn't, I was frustrated and discouraged and a little frightened that I just didn't have what it took to do it. I didn't understand that although 7 years may be a long time for a book, 3 or 4 or 5 isn't, and that would have been helpful to me to know that.
Right, right. Before we talk about the revision, let's just talk a tiny bit about the book. Walking to Gatlinburg is about Morgan Kinnison chiefly, and some of the very interesting characters that he comes across in pursuit of finding his missing brother, Pilgrim. Mm-hmm. So what inspired you to write Walking to Gatlinburg?
Well, the very first inspiration was a story that a bookseller friend of mine in New Hampshire told me. She or her family moved here from North Carolina, and she said that her great-great-grandfather, who had a wonderful name, his name was Jasper Memory, enlisted in the Confederate Army when he was 17 or 18, and he was captured and sent to the Union prison at Elmira. And that was a bad place. It was sometimes called the Andersonville of the North, and also sometimes Hellmira. And just in the last year and a half of the war, 2,900 men died there of malnutrition and infection in their wounds and neglect. And my friend said that Jasper had only one possession of any value. He had a gold button on his overcoat. How he ever got that, I don't know. But he had one gold button on his overcoat. And while he was in prison, he gave it to a fellow prisoner who'd been a dentist in civilian life, who made it into a engagement ring for Jasper to give to his sweetheart when and if he survived Elmira, which he did. And when the war ended, he walked all the way from Elmira back to North Carolina to give the ring to his fiancée, and they got married. And I was greatly interested in this story, and I thought, now you can't be a novelist and hear a story like that and not want to write it. But it occurred to me that it already had been written. Charles Frazier wrote it in Cold Mountain.
Right.
And I wasn't going to be able to outdo him. But the story was still there in the back of my mind, and quite often at around noon, instead of eating lunch, I go for a walk up on the mountain across the road from the house, or in the winter I might go cross-country skiing up there. And one day I was walking up on top of the mountain, and I looked off at the range of Vermont mountains, and I asked myself the what if question. What if instead of a Confederate soldier, my guy is a Vermonter walking south along this mountain chain and then down through the Appalachians to North Carolina to I didn't know what. And a day or two later, I came up with the idea of finding his brother, who was missing in action. And then gradually, as I wrote the book and it evolved, I came up with the five or six psychopaths who were chasing Morgan and who want something, I won't say what, that he has,
right,
that they're desperate to get their hands on. And at that point, the book began to break in the right direction for me. And that's when I sat down and just slammed my way through the first draft before doing much research, because I wanted to fit the research into the story and the characters rather than tailor the story and the characters to the research,
mm-hmm.
being a novelist, not a historian. And so then I took the long trek south in Morgan's footsteps, not walking, but driving.
Driving to Gatlinburg.
Driving to Gatlinburg. And one of the places I went was Elmira, where I learned another wonderful story, the story of John W. Jones, who was a fugitive slave who, in the 1840s, when he was a teenager, ran away from slavery in, I think, Virginia, and settled in Elmira, where he helped almost 1,000 other fugitives north on the Underground Railroad, often to Canada, and never lost one. Mm. And when John Jones got to Elmira, he couldn't read or write a word, but he enrolled in an elementary school, and he went right back to school with the first graders, taught himself to read and write, and became sexton of the local Baptist church. And during the war, when the prison was built, he was asked if he would bury the Confederate prisoners who had died at Elmira, and he not only did so with great regard and respect and marking all their graves, but he sent their effects back to their families with very kind letters. This man who had been a slave himself, I had never heard of his story, but
yeah.
I said to myself, now there's an American hero. And I actually patterned Jesse Moses, the fugitive slave who's important to the plot of Walking to Gatlinburg, after John W. Jones, although Jesse Moses has a different history from Jones. So that was a lucky day that I found his story.
Yeah. This book doesn't all take place in Vermont, clearly,
no,
since he's walking Gatlinburg, and yet the sense of place is very strong, as always is true in your books. And I had the sense, toward the beginning of the book, we're in Vermont for a while, and I had the sense that you must have enjoyed writing this story about one of your favorite places and removing, you know, 150 years of change and progress. Was that fun for you?
It was fun, and I did enjoy it. But I also enjoyed taking Morgan out of the Northeast Kingdom and out of Vermont down south, because Morgan is such a Northeast Kingdom boy that he takes the kingdom right along with him. He's independent-minded, to the point of stubbornness, and he's individualistic, and he has a well, he has a sense of humor, but not much opportunity to use it during the Civil War. But he has a strong sense of family, and he's pretty determined to find his brother, even though he doesn't really have any reason to think that his brother, who went missing at Gettysburg, is still alive. Mm-hmm. But he has faith that he is. So it was fun to write about Vermont, but also the South in the middle of the 19th century. And I spent a lot of time when I was in the South in the backwoods of the Blue Ridge and Smoky Mountains, talking to people and just scouting around to see what I could see. And it frustrated me that I couldn't identify the trees. And, you know, I would look at, I could tell an oak tree, but there are five or six different kinds of oak trees down south. And so I would ask somebody, and they'd tell me, and then I would almost immediately forget again. And also, I am not very fond of snakes, and so I was very careful to look out for especially rattlesnakes. That was kind of fun.
Now, was it one trip that you took?
I took several. Our daughter lives in Nashville, and I combined going to see her.
Okay.
And sometimes my wife went with me.
Okay.
And I particularly spent time in the Great Smoky Mountain National Park, which I found beautiful just beyond words. But I would know that I wasn't in Vermont. Instead of running due north and south in one chain, the mountains and the Smokies are jumbled, and I think they may have been glaciated at some point, but they're relatively unglaciated compared to ours, so it's a somewhat different world.
How did you find the people in the South as far as helpfulness or, I don't know, whatever thoughts come to mind?
They were all helpful.
Yeah.
And I don't know exactly what accounts for that, because I went up into some back hollows where I wondered if I would ever come out again, especially if I happened on a moonshine still. But everybody was friendly and helpful and full of interesting stories, and I did find a few descendants of the Melungeon people that I write about in Walking to Gatlinburg, who told me that their ancestors, in fact, were from Portugal. They came to this country in the 17th century as fishermen and were wrecked off the coast of the Carolinas, worked their way inland, and settled over in eastern Tennessee. And whether this is a myth or actually the case, I don't know. But I thought, well, that's a wonderful story. Yeah. I'll use it in my book. Yeah. I didn't care whether it was true or not. Into the book it went.
Well, maybe this would be a good time for you to read from the book.
Okay. In this incident, Morgan, who has a high fever and is actually quite sick, comes to a town called Mason or Dixon, and where he runs into a talking tortoise, or maybe he just thinks he does. He came to a town at the foot of the mountains, designated on a signpost as Mason or Dixon. Mason or Dixon was a stately little village with several fine stone, red brick, and ornate wooden homes, yet the place seemed to be deserted. Ahead on the village green was a pump, but when Morgan tried the handle, a stream of white sand poured out of the spout. On the south edge of the village, a land tortoise was unhurriedly working its way across the road. Rather boxy in appearance, the tortoise was about as large as a dinner plate, with tan and orange checkered markings on the sides of its shell. It would make a good soup for his fever, Morgan thought. The tortoise stopped, extended its leathery neck, looked at Morgan with its calm, dark eyes, and spoke. "My name is Pilgrim," it said. "I can tell you how this town got its name, and where to look for my namesake, your brother, but not if you eat me." "Tell me your story," Morgan said. In the voice of a seasoned raconteur, the reptile began its tale. "You must know, Morgan, that this town was settled by two brothers. Their names were Mason and Dixon Alexander. Both were attorneys and learned men. Do you see those two great houses facing each other across the street? Those were the original homes of the Alexanders. Mason lived in the Italianate house of orange sandstone on our right. Brother Dixon resided in the big white Greek revival opposite. Very well then. Time ran along, as time will, and their law firm, Mason and Dixon Alexander, thrived. Then they quarreled. Over what? Morgan said. Nomenclature. Morgan stared at the talking tortoise. That's correct, it said. Specifically, what to name the town, Mason or Dixon? They argued over the matter for more than 40 years. During that time, no one knew what to call the place, so they referred to it as Mason or Dixon. Finally, old man Mason Alexander, who was upward of 90, walked up to his tottering brother and shot him down in the street to settle the dispute once and for all. That very evening, Dixon's oldest boy, Dixon Jr., who was 73, gunned down his uncle Mason. From there, it was off to the races. It was pure war, Morgan, with one Alexander shooting or stabbing another one every few years on down through four generations, all over nomenclature. I shan't trouble you with the grim particulars. In time, the clans shot each other out, and by then it wasn't safe for anyone else to live in this town either. Mason or Dixon has stood empty these last 10 years. Why didn't they compromise back before their feud began? Call the town Alexandria. Why not indeed? Couldn't the war between them have somehow been avoided? One would have thought. The fever was coming over Morgan again. He needed to find a cold brook, or at least a pump that pumped water instead of sand. He needed to stop this charade, talking to a reptile in an abandoned town with an outlandish name. He said to the tortoise, "Is there a moral to your fable?" "I don't know." "You don't know much, do you, for such a talkative fellow? I know you should inquire for your brother from the pretty girl at the sign of Gibo," the tortoise said, "and I know I'd like a ripe red strawberry." With that, the animal continued across the street, disappearing in the Johnson grass outside the old Mason Alexander place.
Thank you very much. Well, I'm glad that you mentioned the sign of Gibo, because I really enjoyed, that was one aspect of this book that I really enjoyed, was the pictographs that are associated with the Underground Railroad theme in the story. So how did you come to think of that? I mean, was that something real from the Underground Railroad? Did they have that?
No, I made them up. The pictographs in the novel appear on the balancing boulder on top of Kingdom Mountain behind the Kinnison's house. And the Kinnison's have always assumed that they were left there by Norse explorers, because the pictographs are runic in origin. And I made up the connection with the Underground Railroad. So far as I know, runes were never used to designate stops on the Underground. In fact, I think that there were very few written records of any kind about the Underground, because it would have been dangerous to write down where the stations were. So that was a fabrication. But as Morgan works his way south from one station to another, each one is designated by a runic symbol. And I'm glad you like them, because that was one of the aspects of the book that I almost cut at the very last moment. I was never really sure that I thought that worked as well as it would need to. I'll tell you how I came across the runes in the first place. When Phyllis, my wife, was in her, we are now in our late 60s, and when she was in her mid-50s, she went back to school and got a degree in counseling so that she could be a guidance counselor, mm-hmm. and then she moved into counseling at the school where she had taught for 30 years, and in conjunction with the degree program, she studied a lot of other self-help systems, and one of them was the runic system. she had a little book on the Norse runes, and on two occasions I asked her if she would cast the runes for me. I was writing the book at the time. And both times when she did, I selected the rune Nathis, which is Morgan's rune, which means, in effect, everything is more difficult than you think. And I think that casting the runes was very helpful for me, because it made me realize that this job, writing Walking to Gatlinburg, which had already taken years, might take years more, and that I just simply couldn't hurry it, that the book might take as long as it would take, as long as it would take to write. And I am not much of a believer in runes or any other supernatural system, but it was helpful to me, because from the rune, I did a little bit of thinking, and I realized that I wasn't going to finish Walking to Gatlinburg in 2 years or in 3 years. And
right.
So that was helpful for me to reflect about.
Well, when there's no end date in sight, sometimes something mysterious might just help you.
It did.
See an ending point, and
yep.
It's farther down the road than you thought.
That's right. It's there, but it's a long ways down the road.
So how did you decide to undertake a massive revision just before the original publication schedule date?
I felt the book was just plain too long, and
okay.
that there were sections that I took out that I might use in another book at some point. And I don't think now, as I look back at some of the last-minute cuts I did, that there was anything much wrong with the sections I took out, except that it seemed to me, and this was more intuitive than analytical, that the pace of the book slowed down and the dramatic tension went slack to some degree in those sections. And it shouldn't be very time-consuming or difficult to cut, but if to do it strategically can be quite a job, and I felt I needed at least another year to do that. And I'm glad I did, because at that point the book was well over 500 pages, and I think it eventually turned out to be about 330, and that seemed right mm-hmm. to mm-hmm. me.
Now at that point you would have been working on the book 5 or 6 years already. So
that's
how
right.
How did you have the emotional distance to be able to see which parts weren't working?
Well, I had a very good editor.
Okay.
And actually, I have always found it much easier to cut than to add to a book. Once it reaches a certain point, to add to it requires just gearing up and somehow or other getting to the point where I can pour a whole lot of additional emotion that I probably don't have at that stage of the work into the book again, whereas cutting is more of an analytical process, and once you've decided where the book needs to be cut and how to do it strategically, you can often gain emotional impact by cutting. I've always thought that some of my favorite short stories, particularly Hemingway's and Flannery O'Connor's, have a lot of
Flannery.
Emotional impact that would be very difficult to sustain in a novel over 300 pages, but you can sometimes achieve in 10 or 15 pages, much the way you can in a poem. I'm not a poet, but I admire short stories and poems. So cutting is not usually difficult for me, but as my editor kept reminding me, you have to be careful not to throw out the baby with the bathwater, you know, if there's something, and she would say, take a razor blade to it and do some cutting around the edges and then go back and do some more, but don't go at it, you know, with an axe. That's not the way to proceed. That was good advice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned Flannery O'Connor, and it just made me smile, because there were two authors that came to mind while I was reading this book, and I think it had a lot to do with your character names and nicknames, and I thought about Flannery O'Connor, I thought about the misfit in A Good Man is Hard to Find, and then I was thinking too of Annie Prue, and you do a wonderful job finding just the perfect character names, and your antagonists all had these fabulous nicknames like the Doctor Surgeon. And so I was curious if Flannery O'Connor is at all an influence for you or anything.
But, yeah, she's a huge influence. Now, I have to say that I don't entirely share what I judge to be her vision. If there's a way to do the wrong thing instead of the right thing, and to do it for the wrong reason, her characters will find that. Now, that's meant to be funny. It is funny. I find her wildly hilarious, but I think she's also, I think that's part of her theology and part of her philosophy. Once in a while, I actually have a character like Morgan do the right thing, even sometimes when he thinks it's not. Mark Twain's been a huge influence, and William Faulkner probably more than any other writer has been an influence, but also, I love the South American magical realists, especially Gabriel Garcia Marquez. Mm-hmm. And when I was writing Disappearances, which is full of magic realism, I was reading 100 Years of Solitude, and it was a real influence on me. Mm. I would say probably the two writers I go back to most, though, are Dickens and Twain. Mm. I'm also a huge fan of the short story writer Isaac Bashevis Singer, and I've been reading him again lately just because I love to read him. There's an old adage, read 1,000 books, write one. And I guess that's what I do. I love to write, but I think I live to read.
I can see Dickens in your books because also just your characters. You have no qualms about putting in lots of characters to paint a world around your main character. And Dickens did that so well, too.
Yes, and my characters are, to say the least, idiosyncratic.
Absolutely.
Like Dickens and like the people I grew up with on my grandparents' farm. The chief villain in Walking to Gatlinburg, Ludi II, is actually inspired by my great-great-grandfather, who went right off the deep end at the end of his life, and he built a very high-powered explosive device and wrapped it up in a gift box. And one night he went out and he made a circuit of the neighborhood and stopped to visit all of his friends or former friends. By then the guy was a raving psychopath, and they said to him, "Levi, what have you got in the box?" And he said, "Oh, I have a present from my wonderful little grandson." Well, come midnight, he took this bomb, very powerful bomb, and he secreted it down cellar in the farm family homestead. And fortunately, when it went off, he was the only one killed or injured. But the house looked as though a locomotive had driven right through it, and I have a slide of a lithographic illustration of the house that was in the newspaper article about the bombing, and I'm going to show that in my Transforming History into Fiction.
Right.
So it was with Grandpa, my dear great Grandpa Gleason, in mind that I invented Ludi II. And when people tell me, "Now that guy in your book is over the top, nobody is that evil," I'm going to tell the story of Grandpa Gleason.
Well, I was going to ask you about your bad guys. Do you find yourself in a different frame of mind when you're writing from the perspective of someone like Ludi II than when you're writing from the perspective of someone like Morgan? I mean, does that really change how your process is working?
Well, in a way, it does. When I did get around to going to get my master's degree, I did my thesis on Shakespeare's villains.
Okay.
And I love them, and it seemed to me that probably he had too, because they speak with such gusto that I thought he must have empathized with the villains, with Iago and Richard III and Lady Macbeth, as much as he did with his heroes and his young lovers. And I think when I write from the viewpoint of my villains, they quite delight me, and I don't know whether they're alter egos to me or not. But I had a lot of fun with Dr. Surgeon,
oh,
the vivisectionist,
absolutely.
And with Ludi too.
Despicable.
They have senses of humor, and they are despicable, and then some on top of that. I mean, they're up there with Osama bin Laden, but it was interesting for me to write from their viewpoint. I think they're over the top and unrealistic and inartistic, but I had a lot of fun with them. Just the same. One of my favorite fictional villains is Dr. Lecter.
Oh,
from
Hannibal.
Hannibal Lecter from The Silence of the Lambs and other Thomas Harris books. So I have a certain place in my heart for villains.
I remember Thomas Harris wrote something about how you really have to open yourself to the dark side if you want to be a writer. You have to allow mm-hmm. the Hannibal Lecters into your consciousness so that they can come out.
Well, that's true, and at the same time, I was thinking that the era that I chose to write about was the Civil War era, and bad things happened then, and including the death of 600,000 Americans, and so it was a bad time, and these are certainly bad guys. Mm-hmm. And in some ways, Morgan's dilemma is that he realizes that if he's going to live to find his brother, if his brother is alive, he's going to have to eliminate these psychopaths who are chasing him before they eliminate him. And he's very good at it. And he becomes a little bit too good at it as the love of his life, Slidell, Collateral Dinwiddie, points out to him. And his biggest challenge to me may come after the novel ends, and he has to somehow or other get beyond the killing himself.
Do you mind if I read something from the book?
That's fine.
This was, as a Vermonter, I just loved this section. I thought it was so beautiful. I just thought I would read it if I could.
Good.
When the sap was running, Morgan and his mother sometimes stayed at the sugar camp for several days, returning to the camp through the inky maple trees at twilight behind the big red oxen, his shoulders on fire from lugging full sap buckets all day, seeing the red sparks climb high over the black woods where his mother was sugaring off. Morgan would pretend he was an Eskimo coming home from a seal hunt. He loved sugaring time, and this afternoon guiding Jesse Moses down the mountainside, he looked for any sign that spring and sugaring were close at hand. A blue jay in some black spruces made its late winter rusty hinge cry. That was all. I loved that. I just thought it was so Vermont and so beautiful.
Thank you.
And well, I also thought that blue jay and the black spruces was a little foreboding.
Yeah, it is. It is meant to be a little foreboding. And sometime in the next 2 weeks, the blue jays that come to my feet are right out there will begin making that rusty hinge
rusty
cry.
Hinge
and some
cry.
Morning I'll hear it and say to Phyllis, aha, that is the first sign of spring.
So the book is told from multiple points of view, and I was curious how you chose which characters to be your narrators.
By trial and error.
Did you eliminate a lot of points of view?
Oh my, yes, I did. That's my grandfather's clock.
Is it?
In the background. Yes, I did. And I tried, insofar as I could, to stay fairly close to Morgan's point of view, but I do switch to the villains and Pilgrim's, Slidell's, although the book is written in the third person rather than the first person. And that's always a very difficult decision to make when I first start a book. Morgan could have told this story just as easily, but I felt that since he is, in a sense, coming of age in this book, the only way that he could have told it with as much scope and maybe as much insight as I would have in the third person would be years after it had happened. And although that's the narrative stance I took in A Stranger in the Kingdom and Northern Borders, I didn't want to do it this time. I thought I would go with a straight third person, more or less omniscient, but also staying fairly close to Morgan's perspective, but filtered through some of my observations mm-hmm. too. But it can be a bear of a problem to work out when you're first starting to write a book, because I at least vacillate and will try something in the first person and then I'll see some problems with that and think that I can solve them all by writing in the third person, and I'll switch to that, and I'll see some further problems with that and go back to the first person. I think the hardest part of writing for me is getting the handle for how to write the book, and then finding the heart of the book, which can be fun. That's a process of exploration your characters help you with. But I think first finding the way to tell the story, mm-hmm. can be a long, long process.
Yeah.
And more than once I've written books all the way through many times, only to realize that a character standing off on the side of the action, who appears on page 220, ought to be the main character, and then gone back and incorporated that character as the main character. I wrote The True Account, my Lewis and Clark spoof, through several times with a wild, illegitimate son, part black, of Thomas Jefferson as the main character. Then with Meriwether Lewis as the main character, and only toward the end of that 5-year process did I come up with the Vermonter Private True T. Kennison, who turned out to be the main character. So it is a very mysterious process.
I'm glad that you did give your antagonists a point of view in some of these chapters, because it's very exciting to the reader to know that Ludi too is, you know, on the hunt for Morgan before Morgan knows that.
That's right.
For example, you know, and
yep.
So we kind of see what's coming, and we're saying, oh, look over your shoulder, you know?
Absolutely.
So it's kind of fun.
Adds a little dramatic suspense.
A little suspense, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's a good kind of suspense to achieve, and it's hard to achieve where the reader knows something that one or more of the characters doesn't
yeah.
know. That can be fun.
Absolutely. What are you reading now?
Well, I have just finished rereading a wonderful new book that is coming out right after mine, called The Sisters of Hard Scrabble Bay by a woman named Beverly Jensen, who very sadly died in 2003, leaving this manuscript of short stories. It's fiction, but the stories are based very closely on the lives, very hard scrabble lives, of her mother and her aunt, who were born in the backwoods of New Brunswick, moved to Maine, and lived tough but wonderful lives. These characters come alive for me, these two women, like no characters since Gus McCrae and Woodrow Call of Lonesome Dove. And I wanted to see if the book would hold up to a careful second reading, because this is a manuscript that I helped discover in about 2005. A friend brought it to my attention and told me about it, and I was surprised to hear myself say I'd like to read that, because usually when people want to show me manuscripts, I run for the hills, because that's something that comes with the territory. I read a lot of manuscripts, and you can sometimes find something nice to say about them, but usually when people give me a manuscript and say they want some help, what they really want is an introduction to my publisher.
Right.
And,
sure.
And 99 times out of 100, the book isn't ready for that. So this book I loved, and I called Beverly's husband. And together, he and I and her writing teacher, the novelist Jennifer Levin, found a good agent for the book and a wonderful publisher, Viking. And The Sisters of Hard Scrabble Bay is coming out in June. And I think it's good enough, so with just the right break, it could actually win the Pulitzer Prize.
Wow.
It would certainly be my choice for a Pulitzer Prize. That's how good it is. So I'm also reading, again, some of my favorite Isaac Singer stories, and I'm rereading Joseph Mitchell's up in the old hotel, which originally wrote as essays about the gritty underside of New York City back in the 1940s and 50s. I love his gypsies and his street con men, and Mitchell was a wonderful stylist. I just finished this book, Red Rain, which takes place also during the Civil War in a community on the Upper Hudson River, and is a wonderful family novel. Red Rain by Bruce Murkoff. And I'm also reading a lot of first-person accounts of former slaves for a new novel that I've just started, not based on, but somewhat inspired by the life of Alexander Twilight, who Middlebury claims as the first African-American college graduate, and who came to the Northeast Kingdom and built a wonderful stone academy, identical to the classroom buildings originally built at Middlebury, and established a very famous school here in the Northeast Kingdom. So there's always more to read than there is time to read it.
But you need to fit in 1,000 before your next book. So
I do.
It's good to get working.
I need to get 1,000 more books in. Yeah.
Well, I have one last question for you. For writers who are listening, do you have any suggested course of action or exercise or activity when a writer gets stuck working on a project?
Well, yes, I have lots of ideas, and none of them work very well, at least for me. I think that it's been a long, long time, if ever, since I've had what is sometimes called writer's block. My problem is that if you look around behind you on the end of that counter, you'll see some notebooks piled up. Mm-hmm. And in those notebooks, I've been jotting down stories, mainly stories I've heard right here in the village of Irisburg for the past 5 or 6 years. I've got hundreds more notebooks upstairs. And I've got more than I'm ever going to be able to write and fit into my novels or write as short stories in 10 lifetimes. So writer's block isn't a problem for me, but sometimes getting the handle on a story can be a problem for anybody. And I think the best thing to do when that happens is to do what I did when I left California, although I've never thought of it this way before, and that is to go right back to your material and get some more of it, because that's the one thing other than energy that a writer can never have too much of. And time and time again, when I've been a little bit buffaloed by my own writing, I'll go back to someone who may have given me the original idea for the story I'm writing and talk to that person. Or I'll go to a place that inspired a story. Or even sometimes read. I get a lot of inspiration from what I read. And again, particularly Twain and Dickens. And sometimes when I'm writing, I can hear their voices in my head, and I know some of my writing is derivative of theirs, and that's not good, but at the same time, it can get you started. Mm-hmm. And once you get started, then you'll gradually elide into your own voice. But sometimes when a story isn't coming well, it's because it just isn't ready to be written, and your subconscious hasn't quite processed it. And the last story I'll tell you, I think, illustrates that point. Mm-hmm. In sometime around 2001, I was driving back from a book tour out on the West Coast late at night, and I was on the least inspiring place on the face of the earth, the New York State Thruway out by Buffalo. And it was getting toward morning. There was just a little bit of pale light off in the east. And truth to tell, I probably shouldn't have been driving a car. I was so tired. And all of a sudden, through my mind, there flashed an image, and it came and went in just a split second, but it was as vivid as this book jacket. I saw in my imagination a little boy looking out of an old-fashioned sideways window, an upper-story bedroom window of a Vermont farmhouse, kind of wedged in between the roof and the slant of the L of the house. And he was looking out at a man leaning against the door of a rather run-down old barn. And in the moonlight, the man was smoking a cigarette, wearing a Red Sox cap, and he looked a little bit like the great Boston Red Sox hitter, Ted Williams. And I don't think that image was in my mind for more than a quarter of a second, if that, but it was vivid. Mm. And I thought to myself, well, this has never happened before. I better stop and see what's going on. So I got off the thruway at Batavia, New York, and went into a all-night McDonald's and got a cup of coffee. And in the next 5 minutes, I outlined all of my baseball novel, Waiting for Teddy Williams, which I, to the best of my knowledge, had never thought of once before, right down to the title of the book, the main characters, the main action. And all I can think is that was swirling around in my subconscious for who knows how many years or even decades, and somehow that image fixed it for me in a way that enabled me to, I guess through my imagination, come up with the story to go with the image. I don't know. Go figure. I wish that would happen again, but it never really has. Not like that.
Wow.
So I think that's a story that I was ready to write when that image flashed through my mind, and probably not ready to write until then.
Hmm.
So sometimes you just have to say to yourself when you come to a dead end, well, I think I need to maybe switch to another story now. And although my books take a long time, I can work on more than one at the same time.
Oh, you can. Oh, great, great advice.
Yes, that and the dollar will get you a cup of coffee at the McDonald's in Batavia.
Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you. It's fun to visit.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Howard Frank Mosher. He was really fun to talk to. His book, Walking to Gatlinburg, comes out tomorrow from Shea Earhart Books. Next week, tune in to hear an interview from the archives. David Joss and I spoke in June of 2008 about his fiction, his poetry, and the role of a writer who teaches. Write the Book is brought to you in part by Autism Support Daily, Vermont's first online support group and host of the annual Autism Walk each October at Battery Park. More information is available at autismsupportdaily.com or 802-985-8773. And by the Lake Champlain Regional Chamber of Commerce, promoting and supporting a healthy environment that makes Burlington the ideal place to live, work, visit, and do business, located at 60 Main Street in Burlington and online at vermont.org. And by Vermont Businesses for Social Responsibility, building a brand new economy with old-fashioned values. Learn more at vbsr.org. And by Burlington Telecom, providing Burlington with access to the world. Internet, television, telephone, burlingtontelecom.com, Burlington's fiber optic network. A little short on time today for the Bookworm's calendar. I'll just let you know that today's guest, Howard Frank Mosher, will be discussing his novel, Walking to Gatlinburg, on Thursday, March 4th at 7 at the Northshire Bookstore. And he'll also be at Phoenix Books and Cafe in Essex for a book signing on Saturday, March 6th at 11. Today's Write the Book prompt was inspired by the work of today's guest, Howard Frank Mosher. He mentioned that twice in the course of writing this novel, he asked his wife Phyllis to cast and read Nordic runes as a helpful form of inspiration. Whether or not he deeply believes in the outcome of this exercise, the act of casting runes did help him realize that he would need patience in finishing the project. This week's Write the Book prompt, then, is to cast runes. I'm going to link some helpful website information to my podcast site to help you with this prompt. cast the runes following the instructions on the website that I link, and follow your instincts to discover how they might inspire or affect you in your work this week. So the podcast site is writethebook.podbean.com. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com, as free podcasts. Upcoming episodes of the show are often announced in my blog, writethebook.wordpress.com. And a reminder, if you have comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. Please remember that this station is here thanks to community support and involvement. More information about The Radiator is available online at theradiator.org. Stay tuned. Cheryl Willoughby brings you the world of music at 3 o'clock. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. Mm-hmm.